Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Go directly to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200 unless you're a white-collar criminal. Turns out, though, the Justice Department has decided that does not look so good, so it's going to change. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 10th of September. I believe it is great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You can count on the fingers of one hand, and you would only need one of those fingers, in point of fact, to tally up the number of people who have gone to jail for misdeeds during the financial crisis. One. Corporations have been fined tens of billions of dollars, but prosecutions of individuals have been rare indeed. The Justice Department, according to a memo to federal prosecutors this week, has now decided that is going to change and that if companies want credit, in fact, for cooperating with investigations, they're going to have to name individual names. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
This memo could change how the Justice Department pursues white-collar crime.
It could. You know, it also could end up being not worth the paper that it's printed on.
Robert Ray is a former federal prosecutor, now with Fox Rothschild. He says it's been unofficial policy at Justice to seek fines and settlements with corporations instead of going after individuals.
It's much more difficult, obviously, to find individuals guilty of crimes than it is to hold companies accountable by way of corporate fines and other things.
Especially top executives who tend to be insulated by layers of lower-level employees. Robert Mintz is a former federal prosecutor who now does white-collar defense.
Generally, these cases have to be built from the ground up, and we'll have to see whether the Justice Department of Justice is going to devote those type of resources to bring these complicated cases.
Ellen Podgore researches white-collar crime at Stetson University. She says if companies do start naming names, it could sour corporate culture by pitting corporations against their employees.
You don't want individuals being afraid to ask corporate counsel whether this is a good thing to do, whether it's legal or not legal.
But former regulator William Black, who helped put lots of people behind bars during the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s, doesn't buy it.
It leads to employees telling the truth. Any alternative policy leads to cover-ups.
Black says the memo came too late to secure many convictions related to the financial crisis. He says the Justice Department has waited so long, the statute of limitations has either run out or is about to. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There has been, as has been reported here and elsewhere, increasing pressure for Western governments to do more about the migrant crisis in Europe right now. Today, the White House said that President Obama has told his advisors he wants to let 10,000 Syrian refugees into the United States next year. It came framed as a budget story. The 2016 federal fiscal year starts October the 1st, and the 10,000 people number is significant because it's quite a big bump. We've only resettled about 1,800 or so Syrians here since 2011. Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains what has to happen to increase that figure.
The U.S. offers a couple different protection programs to migrants seeking asylum. The most common one is through the Refugee Resettlement Program, which caters to people outside the U.S.
First, they have to be identified by either the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees or a U.S. embassy or designated organization. And then they're referred to a U.S. refugee admissions program.
Dree Colopy is with the American Immigration Lawyers Association. She says migrants also have to prove they meet the definition of a refugee, namely that they've suffered past persecution or face future persecution.
That persecution has to be based on one of the grounds that is protected under our laws, and that is political opinion, nationality, race, religion, or social group.
The cap on the program is about 70,000 refugees a year. And those who make it over have to agree to eventually pay back the government for their travel costs. Migrants could also try to get to the U.S. on their own and apply for asylum. But Ashley Caper with Human Rights First says it's a small share of migrants who manage to do so. And coming in through the resettlement program with your refugee status in hand has advantages. When you arrive, you get help from resettlement organizations.
Because you're therefore eligible for refugee resettlement services, which are temporary housing assistance, financial assistance, job assistance.
Those refugees can eventually apply for a green card, Caper says, within about a year. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was up, but traders didn't seem too wild about that idea. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Overnight, another 3,500 people or so crossed from Hungary into Austria. In neighboring Germany, meanwhile, Chancellor Angela Merkel's government has been trying to encourage people to help integrate the tens of thousands of new arrivals there and to accept the costs of those resettlements. That is far from a universal sentiment, though. The BBC's Jenny Hill reports.
In a high-ceilinged classroom in West Berlin, a German lesson is underway. These are Flüchtlingskinder, refugee children.
Ich heiße du bitte.
Simav.
Simav is seven. She's from Syria. I've made friends with some Germans, she tells us, and I've made friends with Syrians as well.
Deutsch, mein Freund ein bisschen.
Liebevolle Zuwendung und Verlässlichkeit.
Alfred Peters is the head teacher here. There are 50 new arrivals, as he calls them, in the school. He expects more. Already he's hired new teachers. For now, the city of Berlin is footing the bill.
Wir haben die Erfahrung schon nach dem Zweiten Weltkrieg machen können.
After World War II, we had 14 million refugees coming to Germany. So I think we can handle these new arrivals. As long as the public mood doesn't turn. We need European support. If other countries make an effort too, we can manage.
It's an opinion shared by many Germans. Heribert Hitter is one of Angela Merkel's conservative politicians. I ask him whether David Cameron's recent pledge to take in 20,000 refugees is enough.
I would say no, compared to the population of Germany and compared to the situation of our national wealth, Britain certainly should take more.
There's a warning too for Britain, which wants to renegotiate its relationship with the EU.
I think it's an important signal to take this responsibility in order to keep the support of Germany.
Nazis house! Nazis house!
For now, German towns and cities struggle to cope with a record number of asylum seekers. Outside Berlin's refugee reception centre, a demonstration's underway. Refugees are welcome, cries a woman with white hair and spectacles. These people are furious because in front of them, shielded by a line of police officers, the leader of Germany's far-right party, the NPD, is shouting into a microphone. Frank Franz tells me his members have nothing to do with a recent spate of anti-refugee violence.
The NPD is demonstrably not responsible for any attacks on refugee homes. We are here because we want to put pressure on the German government to stop their asylum policy, which opens the door to all kinds of refugees and economic migrants.
Even Angela Merkel admits the refugee crisis will change Germany. At the school, they're preparing for a busy autumn. And as far as one little girl here is concerned, this country is already home.
Ich lebe Berlin, hat mein Papa gesagt. Ich musste hier in Berlin bleiben.
I love Berlin, Ariona tells us. I've told my dad we have to stay here.
The BBC's Jenny Hill in Berlin for us. I personally am not ready for some football, but time and tide wait for no man, I guess. The NFL season starts tonight, and I will tell you what, it is going to be really, really geeky out there. The NFL is apparently among the highest tech sporting experiences on this planet. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here to make me smart about that. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Guy.
Let's do the infrastructure part of this thing first, the stadiums. I mean, they're getting there high-tech-wise.
Yeah, the stadiums have gotten pretty impressive, and part of the reason is that it's hard to get people to pay the hundreds of dollars to go to a football game at all, especially when the TVs look so good these days. But the other reason is that those games can be kind of boring in person. And so, you know, I mean, it's a four-hour game with 16 minutes of gameplay, TV timeouts. So what they're doing is they're trying to make it worth their while. And that includes everything from getting there, the Dallas Cowboys and the Levi's Stadium where the 49ers play. Yeah. They've got these apps that give people traffic information, maps to their seats, parking coupons. You can even at Levi's Stadium, you can use the app to order food right to your seat.
Wow.
And then there's tech for those TV timeouts. Like they'll have Wi-Fi and Bluetooth beacons that can send you stats or coupons. The Cowboys Stadium actually has touch screens so that you can walk over and look up player bios while you're waiting for the game to start again.
That seems like a lot. But anyway, all right. So what about staying home and watching games on the tube, right? Because honestly, that's my vote.
Yeah, exactly. And that's going to be a little geekier, too. There's definitely going to be a lot more data in tonight's opener and actually throughout the season. Every single NFL player now will have these radio transmitters, their RFID transmitters in their shoulder pads, and they can track everything the player is doing, their position on the field, how fast they're running, how quickly they accelerate, how far they've gone. And some of that data is going to show up in broadcast. They'll give you, you know, like a little Fitbit readout of what the players are doing. And then it'll be integrated into apps on the Xbox One and Windows 10. So you can sort of make it like your own personal video game.
Well, tell me more about the players then and what they're going to be. I mean, it sounds like they're going to be wired up.
Yeah, the players are probably the biggest guinea pigs of all in all of this. They're all going to be wired up with these radio transmitters. They're all going to get their own data. So it's, again, it's like they're wearing their own really advanced versions of a Nike Fuel Band or a Fitbit. So they'll get all their personal data so they can try to run faster and, you know, improve their endurance. And they're also doing things. There's a company called Striver that's actually using virtual reality to have players run plays over and over, like relive the field in VR. And there's six NFL teams working on that. I actually visited Stanford. Their virtual human interface lab is where they're testing a lot of this. And a professor, Jeremy Bilinson, is one of the co-founders of Striver. And here's how he said the NFL is using this program.
Okay. They are using this program like a pilot would use a flight simulator. And that's actually a really good metaphor, because why do you use a flight simulator? Because flying planes is dangerous, so you don't want someone to have an injury while practicing. Flying planes are expensive, and you can't waste practice time on all the fuel on all of the planes. It's similarly expensive to have all the other players on the field with you, whereas in VR, your players are there at the snap of a finger, and they're always there. Mistakes are free in VR.
Oh, that's a good line.
And it means these guys aren't going to be getting concussions in practice.
Right,
exactly.
Right. Molly Wood, she is our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Guy.
Coming up.
Because of consumer, you know, voracious appetite has turned into content for the entire year.
A voracious appetite for fashion, that is, and visual style. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 76 points today, about 0.4%, closed at 16,330. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ gained 39 points, 0.8%, finished at 4796. The S&P 500 up 10 points, about 0.5%, ended things at 1952. All right, you want to start with donuts or yoga? Donuts? All right, donuts. Krispy Kreme Donuts, Inc. cut its profit forecast because sales have been slower than expected. Shares slimmed down 11% today. All right, now on to yoga, ticker symbol LULU. Anybody? Anybody? Yes, the yoga wear retailer Lululemon Athletica says earnings and sales are great, but operating costs are going up. That means slipping profit margins, also means a slipping share price off 16%. Shares in Gilead Sciences rose 3.3%. Then after the pharma company announced a $10 billion bond offering that some take as a sign that Gilead is planning a big acquisition, because, you know, you'll need money. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.22%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's been said many times in many places, including on this particular program, that businesses hate uncertainty. But in one of the biggest sectors of this economy, that would be healthcare, uncertainty has been the norm, and for years now, too. That is thanks to the many legal challenges to the Affordable Care Act. The latest of those lawsuits cleared a hurdle this week, meaning that the House of Representatives can move ahead with its case against the Obama administration. At issue is whether the government ought to be sending money to insurance companies to help people near the poverty line pay for their health care costs. As Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from our health desk at WHYY, this is just the latest problem facing insurers in an uncertain market.
Carnegie Mellon economist George Lowenstein's been spending a lot of time with health insurance executives lately. Not a very happy crowd.
To a person, they seem stressed out, like severely stressed.
Lowenstein, who's also a professor of psychology, says that makes perfect sense. First, the Affordable Care Act passed, which fundamentally changed the business of health insurance. Second, the U.S. House has voted to repeal the law more than 50 times, and you've got all the lawsuits, which keep coming. The upshot of all that, says UCLA's Joe Horwitz, is a lot of noise that distracts insurers.
The insurance companies need to be spending time figuring out whether the law is going to be there rather than just figuring out how it ought to be applied.
There's a belief that if insurers could operate in a more predictable climate, they could deliver a better product. But while the court cases have presented theoretical threats to the industry, health economist Gail Walensky says more immediate concerns have executives reaching for the Pepto-Bismol.
The uncertainty about how sick or healthy the people who would come to buy their insurance are has been harder than the uncertainty about what the courts would decide.
Walensky says insurers knew the passage of the ACA meant bumpy roads lay ahead, and it's on the companies to find ways to thrive no matter how rough the ride. Two recent mega mergers in this sector suggest the industry is betting the ACA is here to stay. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Sometimes, no matter how good your product is, you need a little extra marketing oomph to really make things work. And that gets us to the humble pecan. There is no memorable slogan, no catchy jingle, no quick and easy selling point, at least not yet. But some pecan farmers are trying to change that. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Bradley George has the story.
It's quite dusty up here. I mean, it's just the nature of the bees.
There's dust everywhere in the warehouse of Thomas Mason's pecan farm, just south of Macon, Georgia. We climb narrow stairs and look across a row of metal bins about two stories high.
What happens when the nuts come in, they all come in at the central point, and they'll all dump on this bale.
This fall, the bins will fill with freshly picked pecans, drying before they're packed and sent to their final destination.
Some of them wind up at a couple of the candy places here in Georgia, but I would say 60% of ours are shipped overseas.
Mason, who's also chairman of the Georgia Pecan Commission, is grateful for the overseas markets, especially China, the largest. But he wants to see more American demand for his crop.
There's a lot of people that feel like a pecan is a southern specialty item. We had got off an airplane one day and a guy had asked us what we do, and we told him we grow pecans, and he said, "What's that?"
Marketing of pecans is all over the place. States, farms, and companies do their own thing. There's pecans, America's nut, and Georgia pecans, the anti-oxy nut. Mason and other farmers and shellers want a unified campaign, so they're pushing for what's known as a federal marketing order. Basically, farmers would pay an assessment based on the size of their crop, and that money could be used for advertising and marketing, as well as other things like researching new products. Pecan milk, anyone?
If everybody contributes, then we can all be better off.
Michael Swanson is an agricultural economist at Wells Fargo.
The heart of a federal marketing order makes sense. When things are incoherent or inconsistent to start with, then you have real problems.
Those pushing for the pecan marketing order point to almond growers in California, who have had their own since the 1950s. Almonds are now the number one tree nut, a $6 billion crop. But Swanson warns against attributing all of that growth to better marketing.
Obviously, when you make an effort to bring up product awareness, it improves people's impressions. But the question is, how do you quantify that impact? That's almost an impossibility.
And there's the question of what a big united marketing campaign would look like. I called Brian Matamore. His company has worked on brand campaigns for Ocean Spray cranberries and Silk almond milk. He says pecans would have to break through the clutter of ads for other nuts. But he says people are always looking to try something new. He even came up with a jingle. With a pecan, you can.
You know, when you have a jingle, that can really give you extra memorability, obviously, and breakthrough. And you can find people just saying, you know, with a pecan, you can.
Back on his farm, Thomas Mason has a simpler idea for a winning slogan.
Eat more pecans.
In Atlanta, I'm Bradley George for Marketplace.
Not only does football start tonight, but so too does New York Fashion Week. And while there will be glamour and glitz and parties for celebrities and hangers-on alike, it's really about money, right? About profit. And this year, thanks to a big Hollywood talent agency, things are going to be done a little bit differently at New York Fashion Week. Vanessa Friedman is the fashion director for the New York Times. She has been watching and writing about this year's versions of the runway shows. It's good to have you on.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
There was a great line in this piece that you wrote in the paper today. It's Fashion Week now is not so much business, so much commerce. It's really content. That's the way it's being framed.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think brands have realized that what essentially was a trade show has become, because of social media, because of Hollywood interest, because of consumer, you know, voracious appetite, has turned into content for the entire year.
And it is thus no accident that it is owned now by WME-IMG, which is to say Ari Emanuel, the Hollywood super agent's firm.
Right. Well, I think one of the real carrots for him in buying IMG was the fact that it had quite a developed fashion events business. You know, IMG owned 13 different fashion weeks around the world, as well as numerous award shows. And while most of the other competitive bidders for the company back in 2013 were focused on IMG's sports side, he really saw the potential in the fashion and the fact that it could be, you know, packaged with all the things that WME does so well and turned into this incredible entertainment package.
And now, what are we going to see this year that is different? If content is king, to coin a phrase, what's it going to be like out there in Manhattan?
Oh, there are going to be a lot more cameras, for one thing.
Of course.
WME-IMG is actually making a documentary about Fashion Week, and they're going to be following 7 different fashion figures around. One of the very interesting initiatives that they have begun is that they have disaggregated the headquarters, which was the kind of centralized meeting place for press or buyers and shows, and moved it out of the actual collection venues to 14th Street, to its own space. Passerby, the public, consumers are going to be able to go into that space for a couple hours every day, talk to sponsors, see live stream of fashion shows, you know, really become a part of Fashion Week in a way they've never been a part of Fashion Week before.
Is it no longer going to be then, I forget what it was last time I checked, Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week, right, or whatever it is?
It is not Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week. Mercedes-Benz is no longer a sponsor of the event. It is now simply New York Fashion Week, colon, the shows, because there are actually a number of designers who show not with the quote-unquote official side of Fashion Week, but on their own.
Well, and why wouldn't you do that, right? Why pay what I'm sure is some kind of entry fee to WMEIMG? Why not just rent a space on your own and throw some models up on a runway?
You know, actually, it's more economically efficient to show in the official venues.
Oh, interesting.
You know, you rent the venue, you get the backstage, you get the security, you get the seating, you get the runway, you get a certain lighting package.
Hmm.
However, designers tend to want to do their own thing.
Yeah. But do you expect then with these changes that designers will be selling more clothes and thus making more money?
Well, I think that's certainly the bait that's being dangled. Yeah. There's a sense among the fashion industry and among designers that there is enormous potential in Fashion Week, that it could be incredibly profitable for them if they can crack that nut. The sell of WMEIMG is that they understand how to do that.
Vanessa Friedman is fashion director at the New York Times. Her piece on Fashion Week in New York, which starts today, is in the paper. Vanessa, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, which resonates with yours truly because I just got in from San Francisco this morning. A site called TravelMath.com, which helps calculate the time differential between driving and flying times between various cities, came out with a ranking of some of the dirtiest places in airports and on planes. They had a microbiologist go out and do some tests, and here are the results. Tray tables are by far the dirtiest places on planes, about 9 times more bacteria on them than on the toilet flush button. Seatbelt buckles and overhead air vents are about the same as the toilet button, in case you wondered. Also, and you know, just because, does anybody have a bottle of that antibacterial hand cleanser stuff on them? Do you? Seems like I just got back, and now I got to go. The Dow up 76 points today, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 39 points. That is 0.8%. The S&P 500 up 10 points, about 0.5%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you again tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.